Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dragons, Gazelles, and Unicorns. I'm Rose McCormen, and I'm thrilled to have Brian Bonlander on the podcast today. Brian is gifted in many areas: executive leadership, policy, public affairs, and business development. He has consistently delivered results by combining his skill sets with his entrepreneurial zeal, which I've experienced in person, and it's quite inspiring. And deep domain expertise in public policy in multiple industry sectors, including life sciences, clean tech, maritime, and aerospace. I met Brian when he was the director of the Washington State Department of Commerce. He now serves as the principal at Lodestar Strategic. So thank you so much, Brian, for coming onto the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd love to start with your telling us about your background and your journey from organizing farmers in a newly independent state to being, an entrepreneur at Lodestar Strategic. You've had quite a great path.
Yeah, well, it's great to be here again. Thanks for always fun to talk with you. I always learn something new and new stuff comes up. So I look forward to this conversation. One of the first things I did in my career was I volunteered to do some work in Ukraine, which at the time was a very newly independent state of the former Soviet Union. And I did that because I was coming off of working in politics and worked for a member of Congress, and that person lost in 1994. I'll just note that my sense of, I learned very early that one had to be sort of entrepreneurially focused if you're gonna stay in politics and work in politics, right? Because you're often, if you're working on campaigns, it's very much like a startup. You're having to raise money very quickly. The outcome is uncertain typically. And it's constant work all the time, which I really loved. I just loved the focus on, achieving that goal 2 years or a year out from the point of joining. But then there's risk associated with that, because even if you win, you can lose 2 years later. And that was the case in this instance. And so I was looking for some opportunities just to travel into to experience the world a little and do something though while I was traveling. And so a friend of mine who I'd met in college was, he is Ukrainian, and I looked him up and he was back in Kiev and said, hey, I'd love to come out and hang out, see you, but also I want to do some work and help out with this newly independent state of Ukraine as they try to establish themselves. And he eventually hooked me up with this organization called VOCA, which is Volunteers in Overseas Cooperative Assistance. And I have to say that whole experience was just incredibly fascinating. I mean, first of all, they took me, accepted me to participate. Typically, they would accept people who had many years of agriculture experience, right? That were going to help on, the latest soil techniques, additives, or a type of using a particular farming implement. But in this case, in Ukraine, there was such a sort of dearth of knowledge of what it means to run a business and what it means to build something in the context of free enterprise. They had opportunities for me to help out these little communities. So they dropped me into this little town called Uten, which is in about the middle of the country, out in the middle of nowhere. And then I worked with a group of farmers there on these strawberry farmers. And then I did the same thing with some sunflower farmers in another town. And essentially there were a bunch of farmers and they wanted to sell their product. Typically they had sold their strawberries to the state that canned it, into a jar of a nondescript label that said, in Ukrainian or Russian language, preserves, that looked, incredibly unappealing. and they would sell that, right? And the state would give them a certain amount of money for it, and that's the way they lived. And suddenly the state wasn't, their factory wasn't operating, yet they had this reputation as the place with the best strawberries, right, in the country. Everybody knew Uman, in the Uman area, and there's another little area there that was identified as the freshest, best tasting strawberries. And I would get these farmers together, and so the goal was to put together a cooperative for them where they could work together to figure out what kind of tools they need, both in terms of processing equipment and also a marketing mechanism to sell their products, so they didn't have to all do it individually, right? And so I'd have to explain to them how that worked, and then once they understood the idea of working together in this collective, which wasn't too hard to get by, they still say, you know, but why would anybody buy our strawberries? So we're going to produce something that's going to be more expensive. There's still other state producers of strawberry jam. It's going to be subsidized, and it's going to cost a fifth of what we charge. And so I would, this was a challenge that I recognized was going to make or break whether I was going to be successful with this group or not, because this question was constantly brought up. And I remember it culminated in this like community meeting that we had. And we had I had this one guy in particular who was sort of leading this group of doubters. And he was very, in Ukraine, I found that one of the things that people like to do is they like to get in your face and yell at you. And if you don't yell back, or if you're not if you don't hold your ground, then they assume you're wrong, right? Or they're, and so I figured that out.
You're so calm. I can't even imagine that happening. Because I can't imagine, you probably didn't yell back, right?
No, I didn't yell back. No, but I didn't you know, walk away, right? I didn't just let him win because he was yelling. But he was made a big show of it, and he was decked out in these in a sweatsuit, you know, and a Nike, like Nike pants, and a Adidas jacket that had the big Adidas logo on, because at the time, you know, having a particular logo of a Western company meant a lot there. It was, you know, it was a new thing for them. And you'd be see people wear it, walking around with glasses, leaving the stickers on, even though it's like right in the center of the eye, because it's label. So finally, I had this, like, as this guy was yelling, I had this realization, okay, this guy's standing here, he spent a lot of money for those sweatpants, right? Way more than he'd buy the sweatpants that the state could provide. And the difference in the quality and using that is are pretty limited for the purposes of why he needed it. He wasn't an athlete, right? And so finally I said, look, you know, I was trying to explain to him that people will pay more when you have a brand that they recognize and there's some status associated with it. And when they want to share with their neighbors, they have guests over, which they do a lot in Ukraine, they're gonna wanna break up that jam. And hey, this is, you know, very special jam. And so finally I said, look, why are you wearing that Adidas sweatshirt and those Nike pants? You know, why is it that you're wearing those and not something that costs a tenth of that? Mm-hmm. And he just didn't say anything. And I said, the reason is because there's, you know, it's better quality for one thing, but number two, it means something. Having that name means something. And that sort of solved it for that everybody sort of got it. He was quiet and was very, you know, positive and, you know, shaking my hand and everything. But it sort of spoke to the fact that, at least in Ukraine at the time, there hadn't been a market economy since 1917, you know, since the Bolshevik revolution. And so there was nobody there who could talk about that stuff. It was different in Poland, for instance. Poland, there were still people alive who lived before World War II, and so there was a little bit more of a institutional memory, because they didn't become communist, through the Bolshevik revolution, and so it was just sort of that it was that was a eye-opening experience for me, because it was a frame of reference that, you know, I sort of took for granted. And I think a lot of Americans, a lot of people who grew up in free societies would take for granted. For me, it's, being able to help out these budding entrepreneurs and plant that seed of entrepreneurship with them, really meant a lot. And it was a lot of fun.
So then how did you move through your career after that?
So I knew I still wanted to get back into politics. I had studied biology, environmental science, and I liked the idea of changing policy, particularly as it related to energy policy. And so when I got back, I went back and lived in the town I grew up in Yakima, Washington for about a year, and worked in my parents' restaurant. My parents had my mom still has this little sub shop, and they had, I think, up to four or five of them. So they were entrepreneurs themselves. I learned a lot from that. And so I did some things until I figured out for about a year I had done that before Ukraine. And then after Ukraine, I moved to Seattle and then worked on Inslee's campaign for governor. And that was a long and grueling and ultimately unsuccessful effort, which we lost in the primary. Taught me a lot too. It was incredibly hard work. We were working 18 hours a day for about a year. It was unsuccessful, but I think lessons were learned. And then just after that primary, then I joined a campaign of a person who was running for Congress, and he was an entrepreneur, serial entrepreneur himself, who had started multiple businesses, and he was running in a very tough district for a Democrat, and he had to put up a good showing, but ultimately lost by a couple percent. That was in 1996, and then I went and worked with him on one of his projects, which was an energy-related thing that would take organic pollutants. It was a very early stage technology that was developed out of Pacific Northwest National Labs, which you know of, right? And it was a little unclear as to how advanced this technology was, like how, if it was ready for prime time or not. And the work that I did with him included going overseas to trade shows in Europe, where we'd find use cases for this technology, and then getting their waste, their industrial waste tested on through this bench scale system that ultimately turned out to they couldn't solve the sulfur problem in this little, actually pretty cool piece of technology developed at PNNL, except it didn't work. it wasn't quite ready for prime time, but it was a fun project, and it's still a problem that needs to be solved. There's still all sorts of organic waste from everything from industrial chemical manufacturing to hog farms that just are treated and sometimes not treated at all, and ultimately a bunch of organic waste ends up in wells or in open bodies of water, whereas that could be converted into energy.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the campaigns that you worked on, you said that there were a lot of lessons. There's grueling, and there are a lot of lessons that you learned out of it. What did you learn the most that kind of stuck with you?
I learned some things about myself. I learned that I really like to work. I like to get in debt, really involved in things, and be 100% committed. I learned, I mean, on that campaign in 1996, I learned that it's, you know, probably better to have some check-in assessments to determine whether this thing is viable and whether it made sense to pursue it. I think a number of people sort of reached that conclusion. I mean, ultimately it turned out fine. Jay eventually ran for Congress, which I worked on that campaign and then worked for him and then ran for governor as well and succeeded. But there's probably a shorter, less painful path towards getting there.
So go, no go decision making.
Yeah.
Need to enter that in. So you had this project that you did, this energy project, and then how did you get to your next step?
After 96, I did some sales work. Mm-hmm. I was selling consulting services to companies, to a variety of companies. The company I was working with, they're called ECR, and they were primarily initially focused on auto detailing and auto service stations, but they had just started expanding, and so I was part of their expansion effort into new industries, and they would provide for companies worker safety and environmental compliance services, right? And I would go in and somebody would set up an appointment for me, and I would give them a rough audit as to what their both legal liability might be and their regulatory liability might be and what they needed to do to clean that up, and then, you know, encourage them to hire us to help them achieve that. I went and assessed companies from aluminum smelters to sausage casing manufacturers. And if you don't know what sausage casings are, then I didn't know what they were when I walked in that door, but they're basically intestines, you know, of pork, and they would be the casings for the sausage. And so this company had a bunch of intestines sent to them, which they cleaned out and then sized. And anyway, that was an interesting walkthrough. Very strong odors, as you can imagine. And then, you know, plastic extrusion and aerospace, a whole variety of industries. And I learned something also that's been helpful for me since, and that is, you really have to believe in something, right, to sell it and to be successful. You really have to believe in it. And I believed in that company and the services we provided. But the problem I encountered was that the companies that, you know, I go into companies that clearly needed our help and that were doing bad things. You know, they were dumping, you know, paint thinner, you know, behind their, you know, facility, just doing stupid things that are, you know, bad for society and all sorts of legal and health liabilities associated with it. I went into a lot of other places that were doing things very, you know, we're very focused on doing the right thing, already had programs in place. And the problem was that the companies that were more likely to hire us were the companies who really didn't need us. Those were the companies that were, you know, they were already on top of it. They already had systems in place, sometimes already had other consultants, mm-hmm. yet they were more willing to hire us. And I always had a hard time convincing them to hire us because I didn't really think they needed us, right? I had a hard time convincing myself to convince them. Whereas the companies that weren't, this tended to be the case, that the companies that were least likely to want to hire us, they just wanted me to come in and give them an inexpensive assessment, right? And tell them where their big liability was. And then they would go and sort of fix that and make themselves feel a little better. But anyway, that was, but I found that sort of believing in the central purpose of an organization. When you're working for an organization, you really need to be bought in. Mm-hmm. And when you're leading that organization, you really need to be able to articulate what that purpose is, because it helps, you know, everybody on the team, and it helps your customer understand why you're there.
Mm-hmm. So after your sales position, what did you do next?
Then I went and so Jay Inslee decided to run for Congress this is 1998, and he asked me to be his finance director to raise his money. And he got in that race late. And my girlfriend at the time, he asked to manage the campaign. And so we both, you know, just did his campaign. That was another very intense campaign. It was short lived, and it was successful. We set records for raising money in the state. He beat a Republican incumbent, and interestingly, that was a tough race again, because he was running against a Republican incumbent, and there was a lot of money on both sides. And that was the year that Bill Clinton was impeached, and so our race was sort of pretty static. We were down by about 4 to 6 points for the last couple months of the campaign. And Jay did something that only two other candidates in the country did, and he was the first to do it, which yep. was criticize the opponent for voting to impeach Clinton. So he ran an ad, we had it in the can, was unsure about doing it, but Jay was, he had really good political instincts on this, and often does on stuff like this, and just saw that the public, while they didn't, you know, they did not, were either appalled or not supportive, or did not like, you know, Clinton's actions, they did not feel that they rose to the level of impeachment, and felt that it was, you know, largely that step was taking things too far. And so he ran an ad going after Rick White was the candidate, and linking him to Newt Gingrich. And overnight, the poll numbers changed.
Wow.
It was pretty dramatic. And then there's another candidate, Rush Holt, who did the same thing in New Jersey after a couple weeks. And then there's a third candidate, and they all were elected taking on challengers, and not many others were. At that point, I worked in D.C. I moved to D.C., where I lived for 13 years. I was Jay's legislative director and then chief of staff for the last 5 or so years while he was there.
And so, tell us what it's like to raise money in politics. What is it like? I mean, we have a lot of entrepreneurs that listen to this podcast.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear stories. Like, give us a story about raising money.
Well, first of all, the primary principle, you have a certain number of people who are going to just contribute for ideological reasons, and they care who is running for that particular seat, right, mm-hmm. for that particular office. Mm-hmm. But the bulk of the money you need to raise is through the candidate's strongest supporters and getting them to raise money. And the underlying principle involved there is that people contribute to the person who is asking. So at least right. in politics, when you're asking for like $1,000, it's, you know, yeah, I kind of like this Inslee, but I don't, you know, I don't want to give him $1,000. I don't really know him. I don't like, why would I want to get involved in that race, or, you know, or maybe I've never made a contribution in my life to a political candidate. Why would I start now with this particular race? And so the key is that they're a friend of theirs is asking, and that friend has sort of calibrated an appropriate level of ask for what that person is capable of contributing and given the circumstances. And so that's that you know, getting that, getting people to understand that, and then getting them committed to doing the work to identify, you know, go through the Rolodex, which you'd often have to, as a fundraiser, you or I'd have somebody on my team actually sit down with these people, physically take at the time, a lot of people were still using Rolodexes, so they could physically take the Rolodex from them and just start quizzing them over the names, you know.
Wow. Wow. Fascinating. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's a great lesson for any entrepreneur to make sure you have a warm connection to when you're raising money.
Yeah.
Especially seed funding.
Yeah.
You also get some good corporates to provide money, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that the corporate money and the PAC type money changes depending on what type of race you're in. If it's a challenger's race, corporate money usually isn't going to invest in a challenger. Usually they either support the incumbent or they stay out, unless it's an incumbent they really hate. And so in that race, we weren't going after much corporate money because the corporations didn't hate this guy. He was pretty moderate, and he was active in promoting tech industry and so forth. But you know, subsequent races, once Jay was elected, we would certainly engage. Different industries to be supportive.
So now you have your company, Lodestar Strategic, mm-hmm. and you're doing consulting. Is that right? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So after running the Department of Commerce for 6 years, I was definitely ready to do something new. I loved that job. It was a very purpose-driven organization. Mm-hmm. And it was just a lot of fun. The breadth of the stuff I was able to do, from economic development and promoting entrepreneurship to housing and homelessness and energy. It was great. It was a lot of fun. But it was also, my office was in Olympia, my primary office. I live in Seattle. My family lives in Seattle. And so it was, you know, it was a long commute there and back every day. And so I was kind of done with that.
So for the listeners, how far away did you, how long was it traveling every day?
Well, it's about 60 miles, but with traffic congestion, typically it'd take at least an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it'd take over 2 hours to get home, depending on how bad things got. And I would try to adjust my day so that I would leave either late or early to miss most of that. But sometimes when there's a 4-car pile up, you know, blocking 3 lanes, you can't, it's not much you can do.
Right. Yeah. That's crazy.
But I'm really enjoying the consulting work. The work isn't much different. Oftentimes I'm helping people with their various strategies associated with engaging in government and or engaging in just the public sphere and public relations. Mm-hmm. And it's a little different doing it from the other side, but it's been a pretty smooth transition. I've enjoyed it. I'm going to be broadening my operation here. I'm forming a partnership with two or three other people here soon, and so yeah, it's going well, and it's really nice to control my own schedule and my own life. I think I told you that right shortly after I had left. Yeah. And I still really, after doing this for a year and a half, close to 2 years, I still really appreciate that every day.
Yeah, I know. I do too. I love having my companies. We launched a new company. But basically my team works all remotely. So they don't have to worry about traffic, and we don't have to worry about Now we're not traveling. This is for the right. This is kind of nice. It's a silver lining. I look for all the silver linings every time I have an opportunity. But it's really nice to be able to say, you know, here's when you're going to work out and which your conference calls and so on. So, I'd love to learn a little bit more about, you know, you've mentioned all these kind of these lessons you've learned. I thought the first one that you mentioned about the frame of reference that we take for granted, you know, when you were talking about the person, the farmer and the guy with the Adidas sweatpants, mm-hmm. and then go, no-go assessments that need to be incorporated when you do campaigns or anything really. And you have to believe in something to sell something, and it has to have a central purpose. And you mentioned this a few times, that purpose-driven organization. And then I thought the other lesson that you mentioned about people contribute to the person who is asking. I don't think many people know that. So I think that's a really fine point. Are there any other guiding principles that you've had that you've developed or you have had as the foundation during your career?
I guess if I were offering advice to people, I would say to do what you like. But also you have to recognize that sometimes to get to a point to do what you like, you have to do a lot of stuff you might not like so much.
Yeah.
And you have to build skills that might not be your natural strengths. And while that might not be your ultimate goal to work in areas where you're having to use those new skills, I think they're necessary oftentimes to get to where you want to go, and you shouldn't run from the challenge of, like, if you have to learn to do something in order to get to where you want, even though you know that thing that you're going to be doing isn't what you want to do the rest of your life or isn't what, you know, you're good at, you need to know and believe in yourself that you can actually, you can learn it. And it's really just, you know, oftentimes a matter of just forcing yourself in there and repetition and just learning. Mm-hmm. And you'll build another good skill while you're at it.
Yeah, so Brian, I think about my consulting days, because I did consulting. The last big thing I did in corporate America was I led IBM's innovation strategy practice globally. And when I started my career at Goldman, I had at least 2 to 3 all-nighters a week. It was just something that you just had to push through. I mean, it was just not pleasant. And at the last minute, having a proposal dropped on me, you have to finish it by 7 in the morning. some of my consulting gigs were pretty funny, because going to your point about people have to believe in the person in order for you to sell it. So when I was running this practice area globally, basically I had to sell it. They had to like me, you know, they had to like me and know that I can do the work. So showing them that I could do the work, that wasn't hard. That was easy to sell. Selling into other cultures was always very interesting. And so I had a project with Nokia, and to sell the project, we had to be out until about 4 in the morning dancing and drinking tequila. So I had to work up a good tolerance, you know, to sell that gig. And then we signed it at 7 in the morning. So,
Where was that? Where did you do that? Was that all? Was that in Japan?
Helsinki.
Okay. Oh right. Yeah. Yeah. Nokia. Yeah.
There were bits. Then I commuted to Helsinki. Well, the project was global, so I usually would go to Asia first, and then a few places, one or two or three places in Europe, and then I'd come back to the U.S. and either visit one of the clients here, and then out again on Sunday. Mm-hmm. That's why I stopped working in corporate America, because I was 42 hours on average a week in the air, and that's the commute.
Yeah,
getting to me, I was like seeing the wrinkles over here. I'm like, oh, that's not natural. of course.
That's a lot of air travel, for sure.
That's the airplane doing that to me. So what do you think we're going to see in the new year? With you and I were having a conversation about this, and I think that your insights were really valuable, given the dynamics of the presidency. I would love for you to share with you know, what you shared with me, and probably some other insights as well, what you think are going to, what's going to happen.
Were we talking about the political situation or?
The new stimulus you think is coming out, or, and then, you know, how do people kind of prepare, or can we forecast in some way where that stimulus might land?
Yeah, I mean, if you think back to the last meltdown of the economy during the housing crisis, the Obama administration came in sort of at a similar time frame in the crisis as the Biden administration is coming in, and advanced a big stimulus package, right, which Democrats like to do, and Bill Clinton did one when he was elected, which was, you know, much smaller relative to the one Obama did, and the one that that Biden was contemplating was much larger still. And those are typically focused on infrastructure and a variety of other activities that that would get the economy going. And one big investment that Obama did, you know, in conjunction with the Congress and so forth, was in clean energy and clean tech type stuff, right? And which I think about $90 billion went in, which at the time was a massive amount. It was a huge amount. I was working on the Hill in Congress at the time, and it was a big lift to get that done. And we were figuring out how we're going to direct the money and figuring out how to design programs and so forth, and then get the bill passed. And ultimately, we got it passed in on the president's desk within like a month of he signed it within a month of being president. So Biden has already signaled and had been signaling throughout the campaign that he wanted to do similarly something big. You know, he calls it Build Back Better, where he wants to invest in infrastructure. He's been a long backer of infrastructure in general, in particular rail. And he, throughout the Democratic primary, there was a big focus on climate. And you know, this concept of the Green New Deal became an issue for better or for worse. Biden's campaign effectively took the infrastructure type investment aspects of that and made that his plan, which would amount to doing what Obama and Biden did and the Congress in 2008 and 2009 and multiplying it by 10 or 20. Mm. It was going to be and also over a longer period of time. So that the way Biden had articulated it, it wasn't just for the immediate economic stimulus. It was a 4-year program to build back better. Now that the election, you know, has transpired and we kind of know what the Congress looks like, I think there has to be a reassessment as to what's going to happen with regard to a potential stimulus, right? McConnell, with Republicans controlling the Senate, they're going to have a huge say on what that looks like. McConnell has been resistant to a bunch of new spending as of late. And I would expect that suddenly the Republican Party that has been concerned about deficits for a long time, at least with respect to spending, not necessarily tax cuts, they don't seem to have a problem there, but with respect to spending, they're going to start raising those concerns again now that Trump is not in office. And so you're going to have a real tension as to, you know, what Pelosi and the House Democrats want to get done and Biden wants to get done versus what McConnell wants to get done. And so, I think that there's going to be increased investments into this space, into infrastructure and clean energy stuff again. The question is on what scale, and I'm assuming here that the Democrats do not win both of the Georgia Senate seats. If they were to win that, then that changes the equation drastically, I think, and there's there will probably be a big, much larger investment in infrastructure. And so if I'm sitting, which I am now, sitting outside government and kind of trying to read the tea leaves and figure out what's going on in the context of my clients, or just in the context of seeing where investments are going, I would be looking for opportunities for grants and investments that can create jobs and that put people to work quickly and do so by, you know, reducing greenhouse gas emissions and doing other, you know, double, triple bottom line type things along with that. And so whether that occurs in a separate standalone stimulus bill or whether that's incorporated in different appropriations bills, it's, I think it remains to be seen, but I think that there's a good bet that investments, new and additional investments will be made.
So for our startups are in the life sciences space and deep tech, high tech space. So some of them are infrastructure oriented because we have probably about 40 or 45 that are in the clean tech area. Uh-huh. So there probably going to be opportunities for grants there. What about, so life sciences, obviously BARDA's been putting tons and tons of money into life sciences. Given the COVID mm-hmm. situation, I wonder, do you think that will continue as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that pretty broad bipartisan support for investing in life sciences. I think we've seen that with BARDA and NIH funding in general. So I would expect that to continue, and I would expect the BARDA numbers to increase. Oh. Like Democrats wanting to invest more there, both because of the pandemic, but also because of the clear job creation potential and outcomes that occur with life sciences companies.
Mm-hmm. So this, since we're talking about, you know, COVID and the dynamics around that, and you know, probably had COVID happened 5 years ago or 6 years ago, you may not have created your own company because you wouldn't have had to go back and forth, right?
Yeah.
But how do you think that has permanently affected policy and business development?
I'm sure that a year and 2 years from now, there are going to be a lot of takeaways that are just seem incredibly obvious, but you know, identifying them when we're in the thick of things are challenging. I mean, because there are a lot of changes that we're living through, and which of those changes remain, I think, are you know, are almost anyone's guess at this point. I mean, the, you know, our business is going to start looking at saving operating dollars and capital investment dollars by having a third of their workforce work from home. Mm-hmm. You know, it's clearly more acceptable for doing that now. And I think a certain amount of that is going to, there will be a residual acceptance of that prior to, you know, more so than prior to the pandemic. And, you know, how much of that, if it's 100% of, you know, of the sort of acceptance of people working from home now, or if it's 10%, you know, I don't know. But that's going to have some significant implications as to with our economy and our downtowns and things like that. For startups, and you know, I feel like that it's probably been, could be a, you know, a good thing, because it's forcing people to figure out how to do things remotely, including meet people and build trust and relationships that are necessary for for starting companies. And so presumably if that's just easier, the easier that is to do in the future, the more companies that are going to be started and the more investors are going to be willing to put their money into companies without, having multiple meetings, personal meetings. My sense that would be one of the silver linings, as you mentioned, as an outcome for this. I mean, the easier it is to bring those elements together that bring entrepreneurs, technology, capital, and so forth together, the more businesses we're going to see started, and that's where all most of new jobs come from, or new businesses, right? And so we need to be doing that, and we need to be looking for any way possible to make it as easy as possible to do that. I also think, though, a lot of people, I mean, everybody I talk to, even people who aren't particularly socially outgoing, really look forward to, getting out and meeting people again, right? And meeting in person. And so there will be some pent up desire there. So how that all plays out, I don't know. I mean, what's your sense?
Well, I think that there's this pent up demand. I bet you the spring of next year, people are gonna stick a month off and go places. I think that the cruise lines will become active again. I think that the whole aerospace industry will boom, again, from being way down to going up. And so I think we're gonna see that in the spring of next year after the vaccines have been distributed and the fear has gone away to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
There's gonna be a lot of traveling.
Yeah.
Unused vacation time as well. People just probably rolling it over the next year so that they can just not, since there's not very many places you can go, right. The new shutdowns and so on. And what's really interesting is here, what we've seen is people fleeing Georgetown. I mean, because of the riots were really bad in Georgetown, and people are just like getting out of town. So the other thing is that I think we're gonna see a lot of the urban areas become a lot less urban, and the overall, the distribution of where people are living is gonna broaden as well. And I think the other thing that I think has happened, I'm not going to the gym personally. I have all my weights right now. They're all piled up in my living room.
Yeah, me too.
But it's like, I'm working out my 2 hours, but it's just in my living room. So I think the other thing that's gonna shift is, a big shift, is that people are gonna wanna go to the gym, but I think that there's also this, because this heightened awareness of how sanitized places are, I don't think that that's gonna get reestablished right away, at least. Maybe outdoor working out, but I totally agree with you. There's definitely pent up demand to get out and go out and go dancing.
Yeah, right. Right.
Go places.
Yeah, I mean, especially if the virus is 90% or 95% effective, like Moderna's, and Pfizer's, right, and AstraZeneca's is apparently less so, but that's a pretty high degree of certainty. And if a critical mass of the population gets vaccinated, the risk should drastically go down, even if 30% or 25% of the population are not vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's
mm-hmm. Okay. No, go ahead.
One thing I've just kind of been wondering, and I don't, this doesn't have any necessarily bearing on our, what startups are going to be doing, but I'm just curious if Americans and other countries who do not typically wear masks when they're sick, if that's going to change. Like, you know, in Asia, when you go to Asia, as you know, people, when they're sick, they will put a mask on so they don't get other people sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, nobody does that around here. And yeah. I don't know if that's going to change now that we've been through this.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's interesting. I think that people, you know, when you go on an airplane and people are coughing all around you, and then you get a cough, right? It would be better, you know, people will have a heightened awareness of that, I think. And they should be wearing masks if they have a cold or something along those lines. It'll be interesting to see how behavior changes overall. I think the teleworking, you know, I think people are just going to shut down the real estate buildings around here. Many of the floors are empty. They just gave up their lease.
You think commercial real estate is gonna be like a long-term issue there?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, with the number of, I'm in a group called Cadre, and I don't know, maybe there's 400 or 500 entrepreneurs. And I say entrepreneurs, maybe they have anywhere from, you know, three people to, you know, a couple hundred people. So they're smaller companies. Mm-hmm. And we get together and most of them are saying that they're just getting rid of their real estate because they don't need to be, they can work remotely and it's been working. So they just got out of the lease. And so if a lot of startups do that, and now the norm is for startups to be working remotely anyway, then I think commercial real estate market's gonna tank.
Yeah. And I wonder, like, if you're a company, like, if you're a tech company, you know, Seattle's got, in the areas, there's a ton of tech companies here, as you know, particularly Amazon and Microsoft. The assumption has been for quite a while now is that you need to put those workers together, concentrate them together, because that they want to be close to other tech workers so they can make those connections, and it's more efficient and so forth. But it's expensive. You know, Amazon's got got something like 12 million square feet in downtown Seattle, and they're building out in Bellevue and other areas. Facebook and Google each have about 1 million. You know, I guess part of what they're doing is they're competing for the same talent, right? So they're creating a work environment that they think is necessary to get these engineers to work for them,
mm-hmm.
Keep them there so they're not bouncing around. I guess it's a lot of it's going to come down to what the worker prefers, right? Mm-hmm. In countries like that, anyway, are people going to want to work from home, or are they going to want to be going into the office every day?
Mm-hmm.
And
it's fascinating to me because I have held a couple of investor forums remotely, and it's been actually more successful because. And also the networking opportunities broader, because you get to see all the startups at the same time on the screen, and they can interact with each other.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's not normal to be able to meet every single investor in an investor forum. And then the platform allows for even more interaction versus less interaction. So there are pros and cons. Maybe it'll be a hybrid.
Uh-huh. Well, one thing I've noticed that I thought was interesting that people are meeting new people by, you know, Zoom conference or Teams or whatever, and I found fairly quickly people I'm talking with would refer to that as having met somebody, right?
Yeah.
As having a meeting as opposed to a call. Which is how I think we would have referred to it in pre-pandemic. It would have been, I Skyped with that person, or we talked on the phone or online, but you wouldn't say necessarily I met that person. Now I hear people saying, I've met this person, or they're kind of substituting these interactions with what's typically the face-to-face interaction.
Yeah. So Brian, what is the story behind that plane up there?
Oh, that is a, Boeing has, Boeing manufactures almost all of the airplanes here in the Puget Sound. And so you'll see airplanes like this often like in people's offices, because Boeing will make them available, right? This one here was, I think it was given to me by, it was given to me by Xiaomain Airlines, and it's a mock-up of a 787, although it's not a perfect replica, which is kind of why I like it, because it sort of reminds me of some of these other models I've seen, where like I've seen these models of a C919, which is a Chinese manufacturer trying to make an airplane, but the whoever developed the model clearly took like either a Boeing 737 or an Airbus airplane that would and sort of made some weird changes to it that made it sort of a mixture of different airplanes, right? So I'm trying to remember, this thing has a couple, like the Boeing airplanes are a little different, their windows are different, the cockpit windows are different than they are in than the Airbus airplanes, and then the top of the airplane, this is actually a good rendition because the top goes down into a cigar like this. Mm-hmm. And if you look at an Airbus airplane, it goes straight across. This one, I think I kept it because it's, I ended up just like putting it on a place in my shelf where I was working, you know, in my former job, and then I took it with me. This was actually one of the accurate mock-ups I saw of the 787. I thought about collecting these sort of Frankenstein versions and so I was trying to figure out if that was one of the Frankenstein versions, but this, I think I kept that because it was fairly accurate.
Okay. Well, we just came through Thanksgiving, and I have to tell you, I'm very thankful for this conversation. I really appreciate it. So what are you most thankful for as we just passed Thanksgiving?
Well, I'm thankful for the usual stuff, you know, health and family and that kind of stuff. Those things are easy to take for granted sometimes. You know, I mean, like knees are, you know, those are taken for granted a lot. I took mine for granted until I had a knee problem. I thought, man, this could be bad if this doesn't get better, right? I mean, you know, I'm thankful that the coming out of this election, you know, however it was going to turn out, that things seem to be normalizing, and the markets aren't incredibly shaky despite the claims that Biden hasn't won. It doesn't appear to be collapsing our democracy or our you know, our capitalist society, on which, you know, trust in the system is highly dependent. So I'm happy about, thankful about that. And, you know, in general, I'm optimistic about, I love technology. I feel like that's like, when I try to contemplate the reason for humanity to exist, or what we can do when we're on this planet, you know, while we're here, you know, technological development is at the top of my list, because it solves problems, it allows us to learn new and things we didn't know about the world and the universe, I'm thankful that I again have the opportunity to see what new breakthroughs are occurring throughout, you know, different fields, and hopefully can help promote some of those into making our lives different and better going forward.
Well, you and I share that passion for sure, you know, with spinning out companies. I get to pinch myself every day on that, learning about new technologies and also seeing all these startups flourish. This is beautiful to see them grow.
It is. It is. Well, you've got a great platform for doing that, and that's fun to see.
Thanks, Brian. So I'll just kind of walk through these lessons you mentioned before. Don't take advantage of your frame of, don't take advantage of a frame of reference that you might have. Make sure you have your go, no go assessments. You have to believe in something to sell something. People contribute to the person who's asking. Do what you like. but you have to realize you might have to go through some other things that may not be as pleasant. Is there anything else you want to leave the listeners with today?
I'd like to ask you a question. Okay. I don't think I've asked you this before. I've told you how impressed I am with this, the model that you've developed for creating investment and companies around technology that's being developed out of our national labs and so forth that taxpayers are paying for, and oftentimes we just sit on the shelf doing nothing. When I was in different capacities working in government, I was always had my eye out for figuring out how to, what can be done to help change that dynamic. And a bunch of things have been done around the Buy-Dole Act and other things that would, other initiatives that would try to encourage the adoption of these technologies. You created this system to do it. And I'm just curious if, was that an aha moment for you? Did you see the dots eventually and connect them one night? Or did you work on pieces of this and see that, I should add this too? And how'd that come together?
Oh, that's a really great question. Thank you for asking. So the first transformation I ran after Goldman was at IBM. And IBM was a negative $7 billion at the time. It was a hardware company, essentially. So I worked actually with Nick D'Onofrio, who's the chairman of my board. And we had to figure out, A, where were the discrepancies? Lou Gerstner at the time thought that they were going to be making money, and then they came out saying they're losing money. Mm-hmm. So there was a big discrepancy between what was the truth and what was presented to senior leadership. And so we figured that part out first. Second was, there was a lot of fragmentation across the company. Really significant fragmentation. You're making this thing, and you're making, another one of these. This one and this one aren't using parts, for example. Just a basic foundational best practices things that you should do when you're building hardware. But the other thing is IBM has always been the largest patent producer in the world. And so what we had to do was figure out where we're going to get primed this month. Where are we going to find, otherwise IBM had to be broken into pieces. And, in the front page of Time magazine, it was all these little dinosaurs were, that was going to be the future of IBM, all these sold to different companies. Mm-hmm. And so we evaluated that patent portfolio and found about $15 billion that could be dropped to the bottom line very quickly. So within a year and a half, IBM was at positive $8 billion. So they went from negative $7 billion to positive $8 billion. It was not an easy task. But then throughout, after that, I went to strategy consulting, and I was at Marsh McLennan, head of strategy at Marsh McLennan for a while, but pretty much strategy consulting, and my specialty is growth strategy. And there's three kinds of growth strategy. There's Horizon One, which is the tactical stuff, advertising, price lifting, things of that nature. Horizon Two, which are adjacencies, which you're basically extending a product line. And then Horizon Three is a growth breakthroughs. When you do the growth strategy, you have to do all three of them. And then you have to do a transformational roadmap, because usually it takes a lot of investment to go into the, to actually make sure that you can do the H1s, H2s, and H3s. And usually there's new organizational structures and other organizational structures that need to go away. Mm-hmm. But when you're doing the H3s, you're creating these growth breakthroughs that don't exist. So what you always do is to try and find a starting point for your clients. And so that's where we do a patent search. We would evaluate lots of bundles of patents and try to identify a starting point that could be leveraged in order to drive growth for the company. I mean, the biggest challenge with that is that, of course, a lot of times it's very, very early stage. So you look for the later stage things. To me, waste is a big deal. What was really interesting was that we didn't actually during the course of my corporate career, we didn't actually engage with the tech transfer organizations, except for the corporate levels. We would pass it over to the client to do that engagement. So then after I started my company, my first project was with the NIH, and NIH has one of the largest portfolios of life sciences companies, organizations on the planet. I think it's the largest. And we did a transformation for their tech transfer group. And so it was across all of the 27 institutes. And so it was really fascinating. The tech transfer groups had the same challenges that companies do. So then we started to do some analysis on this, because I was like wondering what is the opportunity at stake across all the institutions in the United States. So, you know, when I'm curious about something, I had my team, I said, I want to answer it, you know, get this question answered, because I'm really curious. I mean, we just found a lot of opportunities sitting on the shelf at NIH, and it's very, very valuable, can make a huge, significant impact in the world. So we did a study, and there's 5,000 plus research institutes in the US, but we could only get data for 245 of them. So we analyzed 240,000 inventions across those 245 institutions. And we did, we actually did this for the Kauffman Foundation, because it pitched the idea to them, and they gave us a grant to do it. And we found that if we could get 6% more of the inventions out a year at a 90% failure rate, we could make a $1.5 trillion GDP impact to the US economy. And that's at the peak level. But then we said, well, what if we could just get 1% out and maybe a 60% failure rate, we could make $1.5 trillion GDP impact in the US economy. So it's a 7% impact, a very small, you're moving the needle a very small way. And if I think about this, it's a 7% lift, 1.5 trillion. So if we could even get better than that, if we get 2% out of the 50% failure rate, I mean, the numbers just skyrocket.
Yeah. And
looking at it from the lens of most of them are going to fail, because we know that 90% of startups fail within a year. So we're not expecting the best. For example, right now we have 335 companies we've launched. We have a 51% non-failure rate, success rate, because normally the companies, as I mentioned, they fail within a year. And so theoretically, that out of the 335 companies we've launched, we should only have like 33 that are alive, but yet we have 51% that are alive. So I believe if you create the right foundation, first of all, you start with the IP, put it together with the right talent, train that talent, get it with capital, then you can truly drive successful companies and lift growth. So, every year we've learned, we're in our ninth challenge, and we do change our challenge model as we learn, because it didn't exist before. And it's really funny, there's two chapters of a book written about why it's impossible to do what we're doing. That's called Disrupt Me, the name of that book. The author couldn't believe it when I contacted him and I told him what we're doing. I said, did you know about that? You're writing the book. And he said, well, you figured out how to get through all the challenges, because there's lots of challenges.
Are you going to write a book about you now?
I'm working on a book. It's going slowly, but we figured out how to get through all the challenges. And what we were talking about before, about kind of the lessons you have to think about, you learn throughout your life. And it's all about, people buy the person. They're not going to work with you unless they trust you, they think you're competent, but they actually also like you. So we have built, more than 123 relationships across the United States with these tech transfer groups, so that we're able to help them get more of these inventions out. So mm-hmm. That took some time. It's been 9 years at it, but it's I'm very happy with the model. We're knocking on wood and praying that we're gonna put up a venture fund, which we've talked about before, mm-hmm. And I think it's a great opportunity now to pursue that. So we're working on something there as well. So that would make it an evergreen model. That's really what I would love to do. And then there's some policy things. I should send you a white paper we just put together. We got it in front of Biden's transition team, so which is great. I mean, they're focused on so many different things, but this $1.5 trillion, we could make it even better than that. But if we could put some institutional capital behind it.
Yeah, I would love to see that. Maybe I can help get it in front of some other people.
That would be great. That would be great, Brian. Thank you for the question. Appreciate it. Sure. And thank you so much for your time and your valuable insights. I mean, I always get so much, learn so much when I speak with you.
Well, yeah, I don't know. The it might be just worth what you pay for it, right? And yeah, hopefully it's worth something to somebody. And I certainly do learn stuff from talking from with you as well. And it's great to hear your story and how you put that together. I've heard parts of that, but it's it's amazing. And we need to figure out how to get the Biden administration or others to take advantage of it now.
Yeah, I mean, we have the white paper. When I send it to you, you'll see the model that I suggest, because we see a lot of, I mentioned inefficiencies, fragmentation. You know, some institutions don't have any tech transfer yet. They're getting, I mean, they might be just getting a $100 million grant, but you know, we're spending $140 to $160 billion every year in the R&D for universities, hospitals, and federal labs. And that's not including the extramural, that's just the intramural. Mm-hmm. So we have more than $1 trillion sitting on the shelf. We only get out 0.01% of it. I mean, there's so much opportunity every single day when me and my team, that we look at technology. I mean, we just think to ourselves, this guy or gal has worked on this technology for 30 years, 35 years sometimes. And we've spent, this one of them we came across recently, spent $100 million from an endowment on this piece of technology that was incredible for cancer. And yet it's just sitting there. And there's many reasons. You know, you have to get the invention, you have to connect it with, first you have to find it, then you have to be able to evaluate it, then you have to, because the discoverability is a problem too. Then if you evaluate it, then you have to license it. And I mean, there's challenges across the board, but if we could change the governance model and change the structure that we use, it's pretty transformational what I'm suggesting, but I'd love to get your perspective on it.
All right, good. Love to see it. All right, thanks so much.
Take care.
All right, you too. Bye. Bye.